free-range study, not locked in computer labs. They move around in this physical environment through the buildings and the gardens, which is, I think, an immersive environment with the libraries, the buildings, the colleges, all part of that. So when we think about aligning technology to universities' mission, we think about what's specific about Oxford and the academic activity at Oxford. So this is an organisation which is all about content creation and new knowledge and user-created content in that way. It's also true that many of the people who study at Oxford go on to be leaders and decision-makers. So our graduateness, our skill, profile of graduate skills needs to fit that. It's an immersive education. The students move through and browse through a wide range of material. Of course, they have everything that's ever been published in the UK available to them in the Bodleian Library. And it's a very personalised experience, that the conversations that they have with their individual tutor will be different from those that other students have with their tutor. And so students on the same course who are going to sit the same exam may actually have an entirely different learning experience up until the point of sitting the paper. We're also preparing researchers to work online and everybody to be sort of more flexible and distant and green in their travel. So the academic activity is shaped by the place, the built environment. And when Alison Littlejohn is talking about blended learning, she talks about the contexts, the technology context, the learner's context, and the teacher's context. And the technology context is really very much about the technology available within the institution. And that's the domain of central computing and the services that we provide. So the availability of tools in the VLE, various tools available on campus. Learner's context, obviously, shaped by their opportunities for peer interaction, their opportunities for interaction with teachers. So at Oxford, again, this is very specific because of our teaching model. It's one-to-one, small group, regular meetings with your tutor for an hour each week. And the teachers are working in a context where they're expected to be active researchers, publishing regularly and performing at the top of their game on a global stage. So our strategy kind of fits with that content creation, new knowledge, a range of media, and a kind of Web 2 approach, that it should be as easy to get your content out there as we would want it to be. So user-created content from staff and students, and open resources for communicating our research. The purpose of a lecture at Oxford, Oxford is still very lecture-based, but the purpose of a lecture is to send students to the library. So the library resources and the recording of lectures and online library lists make sense, but also mobile access to library catalogues. We're also, when we're preparing researchers, thinking about the online environment in which they work. So many of the researchers at Oxford are part of research groups that are in many other countries and many other universities, and they will work quite happily in online environments together. And our challenge in learning technology is to figure out how we can use the virtual learning environment for undergraduate teaching to kind of mirror the skills and attributes and the ways of working that they will need for online research environments. And one of the features of the research-led environment is that on some courses and in some of the schools, particularly in the sciences, as many as half of the students may be publishing in peer-reviewed journals in their final undergraduate year, sometimes as first or second named author. When we make the argument for technology, quite often the model of education is cited as a reason not to. I see my students, I see them face-to-face regularly, but of course that's actually quite a high-risk strategy to hold with that, because all you need is one volcano or a swine flu, and suddenly being in the room with your students is not actually what you want to do, or you may be far away from them, trapped because of the ash cloud. So suddenly a lot of people knocking on the door of the learning technology unit asking what virtual classrooms we have, how the VLE can be used, and whether we've ever recorded the lectures, kind of wants to say, yeah, we mentioned that a wee while ago. But I think that understanding that although that's a wonderful thing to be able to do when you can be face-to-face, makes sense for us to have in place an infrastructure for sometimes when that isn't possible. So our VLE, which is Sakai VLE, has been built in a way to allow access for people outside Oxford so that they can be part of research groups and to encourage collaborative work from researchers in other universities sharing material with our students. It also has a structure which allows immersive browsing. The default in our VLE is that all material is available to everybody, and then we actually ask the tutors to decide what should it be locked and to whom should it be restricted. But the default is that it's open. Students can at Oxford can go to any lecture. Any student can go to any lecture, and in the same way, any student is able to see any of the material in our virtual learning environment. And to be fair to the lecturers and tutors, you wouldn't really expect to see populated module areas in a VLE when there's no such thing as a module, and there's not a lot of use for an online discussion room when you see your students for an hour each week. So those usual markers that people say about how many modules do you have in your VLE or are the tutors using the discussion room don't really fit sometimes with what we're doing. But instead, online research environments and co-authoring papers and creating shared repositories is very much part of what they do. So we have Sakai VLE, and that offers us flexibility in our structure and design. One size doesn't fit all. We couldn't have gone with a commercial VLE where you had to make decisions about how many people will access, and that's based on the licensing model. We have devolved administration on all of the colleges, and all of the departments look after their own areas. We need to be responsive to building tools centrally, and we need to be able to customise it, because not only is it English, but we need Oxford English as well. We need to allow external collaborators into our VLE without having to worry about those licensing restrictions, and we needed to integrate with all the other Oxford IT systems, which is based on a service-oriented architecture. And when we make our content open, we're part of a large movement in the UK around open educational resources. Having an open VLE means that if we need to, we can host the entire collection in our own virtual learning environment and make that open and searchable to Google if there isn't a national repository available. We also can exit. We have an exit strategy. We can go at any time without being locked in to changes from a software supplier. There's also something which I think is very important about the landscape to ensure that our students' experience, these fine young minds, learn in an environment which is not dominated by commercial and proprietary suppliers. I think that part of the graduate skill, the graduate profile, is to be able to question and make informed choices, and this needs a varied landscape rather than a restricted one. And I really would rather they didn't leave Oxford thinking that everything has to be Microsoft or Apple. So I'm sure all departments, faculties and universities like to see themselves as autonomous, but that's nothing until you've tried to untangle the complex resource allocation models that go around four divisions, 65 schools, 38 colleges functioning as independent businesses and teaching providers. And they are independent teaching providers, and they make their own choices as to who they appoint, who they recruit into their college, which students they accept, and how they deliver their teaching. So we try to provide an environment in which our services we're the provider of choice, but of course they don't actually have to choose with us, so we try to make it as advantageous to them as possible. But one of the things that you notice is that when we try to put Wi-Fi, for those of you who've struggled with it this morning, you may know that Oxford Colleges own most of the buildings and the shop fronts and the green spaces in the city, and then it's not until you start to try to lay cables or put up Wi-Fi that you discover that they own the air and the trees and the skyline. It's also important that as a group of learning technologists, we do research, and that our practice is research-informed, and Liz Masterman and her team are very much part of that research, because we're continually challenged by academics, as we should be, to defend the role of technology. And if they are researchers, we should be too, in order to be part of the community. And I talked this morning about student expectations. The students expect it to be like this. And they expect to be able to study and dream and think on punts and in deer parks. So thinking about a few of the things that have worked well at Oxford, and think about some of the things that we have done with regard to the environment at Oxford. The first one is with regard to what I said earlier about leaders and decision makers, and we're actually putting quite a lot of time and effort into computer modelling and modelling literacy for decision making. And I think that we saw a fair amount of that during the global financial collapse, that computer models which had been used to make predictions and decisions perhaps hadn't been entirely understood. Perhaps it was just greed, but perhaps the models weren't entirely understood in terms of the assumptions that had been made in the preparation of those models. And that kind of idea of digital wisdom, that there are tools that make us smarter and tools that make us truly wiser and give us access to information and enhance our thinking power. I think that computer modelling and learning through the creation of models and learning how to create models is an area in which we're spending quite a lot of time. So we have a project at Oxford called Modelling for All, which is designed to ensure that not just students on computer modelling courses or students on computing learn about creating computer modelling. I'm trying to embed that in as many different disciplines as we can. We also have a big podcasting project. This is some old technology announcing that Oxford goes live on iTunes U, which was about 18 months ago. And we record a lot of the lectures at Oxford. And what's very interesting is that sometimes when you ask the students about these podcasts, they feel that the special atmosphere engendered by co-presence will be limited by the fact that we'll be undermined in some way because there's a podcast. But equally, just as many of them, when you ask them whether they would like to have podcasts available of lectures, talk about how they've heard of lectures that were really good that they've missed. Lectures only happen once a year, maybe never again. A particular lecture, a particular speaker talking about something that their peers have been to that they would have liked to have had. So there's just as many of them saying how valuable it would be to have a recording as the ones who say that might make them think that they didn't need to attend. So we put all of our podcasts up into our virtual learning environment, and that actually creates another set of shared resources and shared repertoire, and many more people can access the material in that way. So the other thing about podcasting is this kind of immersive learning, that we can take feeds of content from different departments and aggregate it so that we can help our students to work across silos and draw knowledge from broad themes, that lectures going on in economics and lectures going on in environment and lectures going on in physics or chemistry may all be part of tackling big issues like climate change or poverty. And by actually drawing together material in themes rather than modules, courses or class lists, we can create learning resources in those kinds of groups by grouping material together in Sakai around the big issues. And the success of podcasting at Oxford, I think, does show that if you bring the right technology and ideology and the right group of people together, there isn't going to be a problem. And actually, at Oxford, podcasting has kind of done one of those tipping point things where you bring together a magic moment when ideas and trends and social behaviours all sort of cross a threshold and spread like wildfire. And we actually have so many lecturers now recording their lectures that it's hard to cope with the support for them. We have more than 300 academic podcasters and quite a community growing around it, because they identify podcasting publishing as a way of communicating their information for impact and reach, and the technology is actually quite incidental. They're not really worried about what's going on behind the scenes. They're media literate enough to know that as world-class researchers, this is an appropriate medium for disseminating their work. So the content that we have, of course, is actually still shaped by the nature of the place and the dinners and the kind of mixed environment in which you live and work with academics outside your field. So you can quite often be in discussion with somebody outside your department. You're more likely to know the academics in your college. So the conversations, we have a set of podcasts around conversations where we have two people who are at Oxford together talking about topics, and they will reference other people who are working here at the same time and how that's influenced their thinking. And those assets are entirely unique to the time and the place and the fact that those people were together at Oxford at the same time. So every evening across Oxford, there are dozens of research seminars going on in colleges and departments, and we record those and put those up. And these are born digital and unique assets, which many of which are licensed as OER. And Lisa will talk a bit more about our OER project because they're available for you to use. And the other thing I wanted to talk about is an open data mobile access project, which is called Erewhon, but it has resulted in some open source software called Molly. And this one is also about place and the learning environment, in that when the students are on the punts and in the deer park, and what we have managed to do is to try to bring together data so that they can find the nearest copy of a book from where they are, bearing in mind that there's over 100 libraries, that there's not one single library catalogue, that all the libraries have different opening hours, and that all the students have different lending permissions. So when the student is sitting in a punt, they can bring up on their mobile phone information about where the nearest copy that they can borrow, the nearest copy that they can borrow in a library that is open at the moment. And we can, it's that time on task thing that we can, students at Oxford spend a lot of time trying to find the books because of so many different libraries, but if we can use technology to try to bring the student and the resource together as fast as possible, given that a lot of our resources still are paper and on the shelves. And it will give you a walking route and, of course, a cycling route from where you are to where you want to be. And you can see that this could be applied to where is the next seminar on early religious studies being run. That could be in religion, it could be in the history department, it could be in history of art, could be in all kinds of different places, and students could search for those. They haven't let me actually tag individual lecturers yet, but I think it will come. You can find your nearest lecturer to ask a question. So if we're actually managing to put our podcasts and our other digital material onto to be found by mobile phones and mobile networks, then we're kind of working on an ambient learning environment that you don't even need to be in the buildings. You can listen while sitting in the garden. And the last project that I wanted to talk about is our OpenSpires project, which Lisa will talk a little bit more about in a moment. But Oxford was one of the pioneers of the university extension movement in the late 19th century, and this actually fits very well, the idea of going with OER. But it represents, I think, a blurring of borders, again, between formal and informal learning, that a lot of what happens at Oxford is not managed learning. It's that kind of browsing, but also that we are now making Oxford material available for other people to browse through and listen to and learn in informal settings. And the challenge, actually, for us in terms of the raised expectations, and we've managed to persuade more than 200 academics to sign OER licenses for their material, Creative Commons licenses, is that we actually have to support them in dealing with the feedback and fan mail that they're now getting. I think it's very exciting to see almost competition amongst the leading institutions in terms of providing access to free educational resources that I didn't really think that the UK would be doing. So academics and students as content creators, and the university as a publisher, it's very much part of our core business. We have a learning environment, and part of that is physical and part of that is virtual, but it has been developed over a long time and it seems to be working very well. So, what I've been talking about, which I hope you might have questions about, is just how the choices that we make in terms of the, you can't have all of the technologies that you might want because we do work in a limited environment, but in terms of success, I think there's something very important about the characteristic of an institution and making those choices as to what the staff and students want to do and are doing anyway when you're bringing those, designing that environment for them. So if there's any questions.
We're up to the changeover time, so I'd suggest if any of you were wanting to go to other ones, you know, now's the 5 minute period. But in that 5 minutes, if you're happy, we can do some questions if some people are coming and going. So
I'll be happy to.
A couple of comments and a question. I think you have to be careful not to confuse the licensing rights of a VLE with the access permissions of the content. If I'm not criticising Sakai, it's a wonderful platform, but it's OERs in a commercial platform. And it doesn't really matter if it's commercial or not. And on the other hand, it's also not necessarily trivial exporting content from one open source VLE to another, taking it from Sakai to Moodle. I think the important there, more than the fact it's open source, is that we're using educational standards to represent the information. And the question was, I wanted to know if you're doing anything with social learning and tools for mashups and helping students.
Well, we certainly do a lot with social learning. That's about what it is to be part of the community. Do you mean doing that, learning with other people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all the students are at Oxford or on campus and learn as part of that community. I didn't mean to imply that you couldn't put OERs into a commercial VLE. And certainly when going into discussions with a commercial VLE and they are asking how many people will access your material, and I say the whole world, they get a bit more anxious. So it's the idea of opening up and providing a platform for everyone else to use our OER, which is what my Open VLE allows me to do, which is different from using an OER in a commercial VLE. But I agree with you in terms of standards and interoperability. It's all about that. But you know, I have a whole area of my VLE that's completely available to be searched by Google and material uploaded and downloaded at any time. So.
I actually have two questions. Do you use Camtasia Relay to, I don't know if you're aware, it records a lecture and sends it automatically to a server, which would be available to students almost instantaneously. Do you use that system?
We don't have any automatic capture. That's a lot to do with the rooms and the technology in the rooms. We mostly go for audio. We just put a lapel mic on people. It's no intrusion into what they're doing. We do it with fairly simple sound recorders. Somebody runs back to the center and loads it up onto the server. And with licensing, we can have it up on iTunes U within 24 hours. And obviously, we can have it much quicker into our VLE if we want to. But that's to do with how many staff are on campus.
And I have another question to do with open source. So if it's a podcast, student downloads it. What would stop that podcast being used in another system, another university system, maybe sold commercially? Would that be allowable under the licensing law? Could you do something like that?
Well, any student can, or anybody can, download things from iTunes U for personal use and study, and all our material is available free from iTunes U and from our own website. The stopping somebody from using it is difficult. There isn't it doesn't explode after 10 minutes or anything like that. But the license that is on our OER material, which is very clearly marked as OER, says this material has been licensed for you to reuse in your teaching. You can use it in other courses. You can use it in other places.
But can a university actually sell a course that uses your materials?
It's not for commercial use, no.
Okay, but can it use a URL? Can it set a course that links the URL to your system? Because that's one of our dilemmas with YouTube. Can we actually use a YouTube link that we know that's illegal or maybe illegal? Can we actually link the URL within a
copyright is about taking copies. So if you're linking to it, that's not quite so much of an issue. That if you're, I mean, obviously the copyright protection is.
That worried us a little bit. Actually.
Okay. Well, certainly there are some projects within Oxford which have looked at one from with Marion Manton, who will be at the Design Bash tomorrow, where they have looked at trying to create courses using only OER material and tried to bring that together, and the struggles that they have had around the different licensing on the OER was very much that informed our decision to license all of our Oxford material under one license if we possibly could, and to try to stop people who are trying to reuse our material having to guess which of the many licenses we have. So we've gone for Creative Commons, non-commercial, redistribution,
attribution, share alike, non-commercial.
There we go. There's been a couple people who have made changes to that, but the idea was to get one sign-off that could be consistent across all of our material. So when you see the Oxford brand, you know that the material that you're getting, as well as being from an academic at the top of their game, somebody employed by Oxford, it will be unique, it will be recent, and the licensing is clear for what you can do with it.
We'll need to wrap up for now, if you join me. Thank you for your great
Thank
talk.
You. Elise is going to tell you more about that right now.